and welcome to the Clever Tax Podcast, Creating Useful People. I'm Jodie Cook, and today I'm joined by Mike Bander. Mike is one of the youngest people to have ever been awarded an honorary doctorate. He was also awarded a British Empire Medal in the 2017 Queen's Birthday Honours List for services to young entrepreneurs in the West Midlands. Having started his first business at just 15, Mike is currently a founding partner of Turn Partners, which owns a group of exciting ventures. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So I've known Mike for several years and he definitely has one of the most entrepreneurial mindsets of anyone I know. Mike, what do you put that mindset and attitude down to?
I think there's a plethora of things that I put the entrepreneurial mindset down to. I think it's something that has always been there. There's always been a nub of interest in enterprise and entrepreneurship. And I think before that formed as a love and a passion for entrepreneurship, it started as a focus and desire to figure out how things worked and in order to create things. So I always see that from the motivation of wanting to do something, I could have gone into art, I could have gone into engineering or maths or something like that, but actually I'm just not very good at art, maths or anything that I needed to do that. So business and enterprise, which is, I kind of see as the human version of being creative and the commercial version of being creative, was the route that I kind of built on from this initial nub of motivation and just wanting to create.
So when was your first exposure to a kind of enterprising or entrepreneurial like situation?
I cannot remember the first because I think I've always had this exposure. I think my dad was actually always really keen for me to have this exposure. I mean, enterprise, if we unpack what entrepreneurship is, it's essentially a mindset, an attitude, I think like a set of beliefs on the world, but also passion, drive, resilience, persistence, and these are like the characteristics. And then it's also a lot of other skills, so like negotiating or understanding commercial models or seeing opportunities, building relationships. So I think when you're looking at where exposure to that started, it started for me super, super early on when my dad would maybe, if we were at a car boot sale and he'd give me 50p to go and buy, I don't know, like a toy that had like a pound price tag on or something, you know, and these were real things that I was exposed to quite early on that right then I didn't think, oh yes, I want to be an entrepreneur. Like I'm being a mini entrepreneur here. But I think all of these skills and just mini exposures kind of built up an awareness that you can ask questions. I think an awareness that not everything has to be as it seems. Not everything has to be obvious. And I think that me understanding that, me just, not even understanding, me just knowing that that's the thing from an early age, I think I was highly entrepreneurial before I knew what entrepreneurship was.
So when you were growing up, what did your dad do for work?
So my dad is an incredible guy. He's always worked on corporate sides. So my dad's actually Iranian. He moved to England when he was 16. He studied in college here, met my mum. And he's an engineer, essentially, by trade. He's an electrical engineer and then worked in engineering companies, then moved on to the business side of it because he is really entrepreneurial as a person. He's always been in big corporates, always done really well. But he's always had businesses on the side. So he runs a property business as well. He had a business when I was younger, which basically did import and export of small electrical products and things like that. So the majority of his time, and he's always worked really hard, was within a business. But he's always been hungry and always actively done lots of different things.
So when you were growing up, what was your experience? What was your knowledge of what your dad was doing for work at the time?
Minimal, I'd say. He traveled quite a bit. So I think that my understanding of what he did, and actually my understanding of the working world, was you would wake up, you go to the office, you might go away to America for a week every now and then, and you come back and you wear a suit and you have a briefcase and that's it. Actually, I've not thought of this before, but I think that's why enterprise is so inbuilt in me, because all of the entrepreneurship that my dad did was actually outside of work. I'm sure he was entrepreneurial at work, but so for me, that was how you are as a person, and work was when you put the suit on and you go and sit in an office. My mum was a nurse, so she was originally a nurse, and then when my brother and I were born, she went into audiology and just worked turn times and stuff. So she's always been like always been around us. Like, she was always really, really passionate about us not going home without her being like, she always picks up, drops us off, and they were fortunate enough to be able to do that, and it's not possible for everyone. So my understanding on work from my mum's side was always the kind of hospital side, the nursing side.
So you've mentioned art and maths as not being your strongest subject. Talk to me about school. What were you like at like primary school?
Throughout my whole school career, and I think I'm quite bad at chronologically putting things in from school memories, I've always actually had quite good relationships with my teachers. So I was always in like a nice middle ground of, I think I was naturally smart, but more importantly, I was interested and motivated to learn. I think that came from just potentially who I am, but also I was driven at home to, I was always asked questions about what I had learned at school and what that means. And mum and dad actually, and my wider family, I always felt like I was teaching them something when I got back from school. And I'm thinking about it, this is so weird, because we're having these conversations and I'm now unpicking my parents' parenting technique. I think up until now, I probably feel like I genuinely was teaching them something. But when you're at primary school and I'm telling them what I've learned, and they're like, wow, that's really interesting, like, tell me more. That internalizes the stuff that you're learning, right? So I think actually I was always having relative, not adult conversations, but more mature conversations about the topics I was learning outside of school, which then naturally became a part of how I would interact inside of school. And I think the teachers liked that because they liked the fact that I was involved. They liked the fact that I asked questions. The majority of them did. I know a lot of people didn't.
Some of them were threatened by it.
Necessarily threatened, but I think when you're teaching 30 kids and you've got one kid that's always asking, but why? Like, what? And particularly, I remember one math class, this is in middle school now, where I absolutely could not get my head around algebra. It was some sort of algebra lesson. And all I was asking for was, why would I need this in the real world? And I wasn't being annoying purposely, like, because that sounds like I'm being a smart ass. I was genuinely asking, please tell me, like, please make this real for me, and I'll know it, and I'll learn it instantly. But when it's all hypothetical, I struggle to learn on stuff like that. I always have. And I think that's annoying for some teachers, because all they want is just, or not all they want, what a lot of people want is just learn the material and do the exam, mm-hmm. which is a broken model.
So did you ever get an answer for that?
Not in that particular class, but often I did, actually. And often I think that teachers, more often than not, go into teaching because they want to help develop kids. They really believe in it. And I think actually when you're churning people through big classes, 30, 40 people in the class, I think it's quite easy to fall into this, okay, let's just get the material out. So when I think I was asking these questions, it kind of potentially brought people back to the fact of why they were there. Mm-hmm. And I always actually found that the smaller classes I was in were much better. And I think it's because of that.
Did any of your teachers in particular stand out to you?
Loads.
As being like role models, say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the ones that stand out most are ones that I felt like I had more than a one-way relationship. Okay. So I remember, and obviously it's easier to form relationships with teachers when you're older because you're not three. but yeah, I've got some amazing memories of, I had a business teacher called Miss Hunton, and I remember that it almost felt like peer learning, if you like. It was just a conversation all of the time, and she took us through all the materials and really internalized it for us. But actually it was real all of the time. It was real all of the time. I had an RE teacher called Mr. Chowdhury, and he really shook things up. He really, in the school, he used to swear in the classrooms and stuff, and everybody was like, just hated it, the other teachers. But everybody related with him, and he turned a topic which previously, in a previous school, nobody was interested in, you know. They kind of just wanted to tick the boxes. Okay, we know the four or five main religions, that's fine. But he really pushed us to understand what that means in life and treated us as adults. So I think that's a massive thing. Quite early on, I had a teacher called Mrs. Armitage, and she was a history teacher. And I remember one time I was a bit taken aback because I always had this good relationship with teachers. I remember she was really banterous to me in front of a class. I can't remember the specifics about it. And I think that was the first time that and this is quite young, that a teacher had almost given back what I gave to them, and it kind of caught me off guard a bit. But then that's just, it's personal resilience. It's socializing you with how people communicate at different levels. But what I found is I've got a lot of really great memories with a lot of really great teachers, but I've had different relationships with them all. And from primary school, it's almost been like, or when you're in nursery or 4+, these role models are parent focused, if you like. And then up to college, they become, and through to university, they become more like two-way mentor relationships, you know. And I think that's really important that's been really important for my development, to be able to mature the relationships I have with teachers as I've been through the system. I think one thing that really was beneficial for me was I switched from my high school to a different high school for my sixth form, which not a lot of people did in my area. But what that meant was I came into this high school, or this college, which was the same as a high school, and I formed new relationships with all the teachers, whereas my other peers, they had the same relationships as when they were in year 8 or year 7 or whenever they started. And that was a world of difference, because I came in as a 16-year-old. I was quite mature as a 16-year-old. I was running a business at that age.
You're 6'4" already.
I was 6'4", yeah. I was taller than all the teachers. And I had this relationship that was how I learned from you, you know, how I'll speak to peers. And I always respected that they knew a lot. I always respected that they cared and they did. But I must admit that I've had a few teachers along the way where now I feel awful, because there's probably been a few teachers that I haven't respected, and I hate the fact that I have been in that position. But teachers that clearly don't care, teachers that clearly, there was one business teacher in one of my schools that came in hungover, and she would just talk about all what she drank and smoked the night before. Another maths teacher who just literally didn't care at all, and I was a terror. But I was an absolute terror, because why would I give them time when they wouldn't give me time? Mm-hmm. And I'd instigate things like within this maths class. This is awful. when the teacher left the class, I handed out all of the chalkboards to everyone, and I made everyone draw their faces on the chalkboards. And we all just held up these chalkboards on our faces when he came in, and no one removed them for about half an hour. And like, so I think it's really important for people to have these two-way relationships, because kids are smart, you know. Kids need that.
So it sounds like from a very early age you developed a kind of authenticity detector.
Yeah.
And actually it resonates quite a lot with what we were actually just talking about before we started recording, like the whole personal brand workshop. Should you have to go to a personal brand workshop in order to work out how to portray yourself online? So where do you think that came from? Where did you get such a strong sense of whether someone's real and genuine and whether they're not?
I think that largely comes from my mum, to be honest with you. Well, from all of my family, but particularly from my mum. I have an amazing relationship with my mum, and she is probably the most emotionally intelligent person that I know. She's highly emotionally intelligent, but she has so much time for people. And I think that meeting people with her, seeing how she is with people, she's super genuine, super, super open, pure, and that changes how people react back to you. So I think that I've always been able to see how people react with people close to me. And we also traveled a lot when I was young. So we would go to Kenya, we'd go to like Mexico, we'd go to amazing countries, which actually is quite a culture shock when you're like 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
But actually seeing how people operate in different areas, in different communities, I think it's just this widening exposure of humans, if you like. And I think that, I'm not sure there's any particular lesson of when somebody looks up to the left, making something up, or, you know, it's not tactical like that. But I think it's a real intangible set of lessons coming from experiences.
So lots of traveling. And then when you were younger, were there any like particular sports or hobbies that you were into? Like, I've seen you play rounders, so I don't know if that was one of your specialties, but were there any others that you were just kind of, that you got involved in?
Yes, there were. So I swam quite a lot. So actually one thing about my childhood is when we're talking about socialization and stuff, I always had like good sets of friends, but I always lived a little bit further away from my friends and from school. So I didn't always go out after school every day to play. And I did, but not as much as some of my other friends. But we were always busy. Like, we always did stuff as a family. We always, mum would never get us in, even when we were young, and put the telly on. Mm-hmm. It was conversations. It was eating dinner together every day. It was cubs, like beavers. My brother and I swam competitively from quite an early age. We did roller hockey. We did community-based stuff we got involved in. And I think that I didn't quite appreciate it until I was thinking about this podcast. I didn't quite appreciate how much that probably did have a massively positive impact on me.
So what kind of things did you talk about around the dinner table?
When I think about it and not think about specifics, I think everything. I don't think there was anything we didn't talk about. There obviously was, but I would never do something and not talk to my parents about it. Mm-hmm. And I felt at the time that there was nothing that they would do and not talk to me about. Obviously there was, but I never had that sense. I always felt like they respected me as an individual.
And so when you go back to it at school then, and when you were quite vocal in asking teachers things and always being the one to put their hand up and go, but why? Mm. Because in some schools, depending on the culture of the school, you wouldn't get away with that with some of the other kids. Mm. If it was that kind of school where kids like to take the mick out of other ones, where did you sit on that? Like, where was your kind of social filter in that situation?
In terms of being a geek?
Yeah.
I was naughty as well.
Okay.
I would get away with a lot. This is a big confession. I once set my classroom alight by accident. That's naughty. Like, I would always, sorry, just to clarify before people think I burnt my school down, I basically sprayed like links on the wall and lit it, and it like went up into like a ball of flames. Like, I was naughty. I was part of not naughty, cheeky, actually. Mm-hmm. And I always had I think socially I kind of sat between, I always had time for people, I think, coming back from my the way I was brought up. So I would always make time and have conversation with who would be considered as like the geeks and nerds and stuff that other people wouldn't speak to. But I would also always have a conversation with anybody. I would be involved in a couple of groups of friends. I didn't really see those social boundaries. Obviously, schools are quite brutal. And of course, there's been situations where like one group has been nasty to another group and stuff like that. But I never really fully subscribed to it. I remember I had a fight once, which is just so out of my character. And it was only because this guy like said a flippant comment about my mum. And it wasn't even my mum. It was like, yo, mum. You know? And I remember I had this fight. And that really upset me because I didn't fight. I wasn't a fighter. And more than that, I didn't like the fact that I had this divide with somebody. I didn't like the fact that it was them and me. And he's got people with him and I've got people with me. Didn't like that. I didn't subscribe to that. And I think actually in schools where bullying is a thing and everything, it's a really, really difficult one to deal with. And I don't know much about it, but I think that just almost trying to see through these boundaries and these groups and enabling people to rise above them is the best way to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Because kids, toddlers, they don't know groups. Like they don't care what, like how much money their family have come from, what race they come from, what background they come from. They don't care. Like this is learned behavior. And I think actually if we can keep that behavior not learned, you know, or keep that openness within kids, yeah, that's kind of it.
So how did you develop such a strong awareness of it? Because that's a very young age to kind of be aware that you don't like the divide.
I think it was ignorance. I think it was, I even now I like don't subscribe to certain social norms because I'm like, oh no, let's just not look at this issue, but actively be on both sides of this. Like mm-hmm. I always do this politically, like in businesses and works and clients that I work with. I do it quite a lot in universities actually. So mm-hmm. I do enterprise and entrepreneurship support within universities. And a lot of people bring me into universities because they have the old academics, which sometimes are reluctant to change. And people that are quite progressive and want to put entrepreneurship into the curriculum. And I'm useful in that situation because I'll go in and I will not subscribe to the existing divides and I'll just like help find resolutions and communication between them. And often these divides are created on assumptions that both individual groups have about the others, which are totally untrue. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is obviously articulated better now I'm older. You know, 20 years ago when I was eight, I wasn't thinking about this. But I think partly planned ignorance, partly really strong socialization from an early stage, getting me involved in different communities, travel, really good. I remember, so I'm half Iranian, so I'm like tan. I've never really had race as an issue in my life, and I didn't really understand it. I remember when I was, I can't remember the age actually, maybe year 5 or 6, there was a black kid called Jerome, who was like the year or two older than me, and I got a new coat. He said to me, "Oh, where did you get your coat from?" And I was like, "Oh, well, I got it." And he was like, "Did you get it from the curry store?" And like, that's obviously like racially focused. But this is kind of just proved my planned ignorance. I didn't understand why he was saying that to me, because I thought, hang on a minute, like, you're black, I'm brown, these friends are white, like, I'm in between you both. So I think I half thought that there wasn't a difference between me being black or white or brown or whatever. I was just like, I don't understand why you would even say that, you know, like, I don't get it. And I think that's probably the best way to respond to somebody saying something negative or racist or something like that. Because it's like, hang on a minute, let's just unpack what you're saying there. Like, explain to me your thinking there, Jerome.
Maybe we should interview Jerome next
I hope he's doing well. I think that's just another example of, I've grown up aware of my heritage and stuff like that. Probably not as much as I would like, actually, but having a mixed background, having really good exposure to lots of different things has actually formed a foundation of me just being super open. And anyone can be, I fundamentally believe, one thing I absolutely believe is that it's not what you are, but it's who you are. And it's not what you do, it's how you do it. Mm-hmm. And I always will give people the chance and opportunity to be who they want to be and do things how they want to do it. And that's what's important.
Mm-hmm. So when you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Everything.
What did you not want to be when you grew up?
I mean, so you asked a question about sport. I swam and I did lots of things like that. I wasn't particularly into football and things like that. I think because it just didn't really interest me massively. I was always much more involved in the social side of it. So I was on like the basketball team and the rugby team and things like that. I was useless, Jodie. Like, I was full-on bench warmer, but I would love it. I would absolutely love it. And I would always be, like, a part of the team, but more for just having fun, essentially.
Which is very applicable to what happens in the Rounders games I've played with you. Yeah. You're very enthusiastic, and you do a very good job of looking like you know what you're doing.
I'm useless. But that's the thing. So I organise these Rounders games, right? And, mm-hmm. and the reason why I did it was because Rounders is a childhood sport that has zero barriers to entry. You don't have to be good. It's actually just about getting people around. And yes, you can run. You can be good or bad if you want. And it's just fun. And I think that's always been my approach to sport, apart from swimming, which I took more competitively. Mm-hmm.
Like the inclusive side of it.
Yeah, yeah, the community side, yeah. Sorry, you asked a question which I went off on.
I asked, what did you want to be when you grew up?
So I never wanted to be a sports person.
Yeah.
Apart from when the Olympics were on and stuff. And I was like, yeah, that looks great. I wanted to be everything, Jodie. Honestly, I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a doctor. My dad's mum, my nan on my dad's side, I only met her a couple of times, actually, because she lived in Iran, but she would always hold my hand and she said, "Oh, you're going to be a doctor. You're going to be a doctor." So when I actually, she sadly passed away, and when I got my doctor, I was like, yeah, yeah, like, not a useful doctor, but I've got the title of a doctor. And I just wanted to make things. I remember having conversations, and Dad and I always used to do, because he's an electrical engineer, I always used to buy these, or he used to buy these kits from Maplin, and you would basically have a circuit board and lots of different components, and you'd solder them together and put a battery in, it would be like a flashing, like Christmas tree or a dice or something like that. And I was always into making things. And if I got a toy that I liked, I would break it within the week, because not purposely, because I would be like, I love this so much, how does this work? Like, let's pull off all of these bits and see what's inside. And it would drive my parents crazy because I wasn't so good at putting them back together. Or in fact, I got bored before I put them back together. And what I realised was I wanted to create. I wanted to take things that were already there. I wanted to put them together in different ways and create things, add value. And I think as I cycled through all of the things of, yes, I could be like a lawyer, yes, I could be a doctor, yes, I could be whatever else, the thing that excited me was that I wanted to create, I wanted to add value, I wanted to build new things. And yes, I could have been an architect, and yes, I could have been whatever else, but the thing that actually really stuck with me is enterprise and entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. because it was the one thing that I saw as a route that had no boundaries, that had no barriers, no ceiling. You know, if you're a lawyer, man, you can do amazing work. You really, really can. And you can build amazing like legal practices. But ultimately, as an individual, you have a finite amount of time. And I do like the idea of being an architect or an engineer because you can build things that last. Like, that inspires me now when I go to a new city and I'm like, wow, people have created this. I want to be part of that. But for me, with my skill sets, my interests, my exposure, enterprise and entrepreneurship was the thing because it was a case of, I can create something from today mm-hmm. that can then continue to build and grow. I vividly remember I was 13. Is this too old to talk about 13?
No, go for it.
Cool. I was 13 and I'd come to this conclusion where I was like, right, I'm gonna run my own business. My uncle ran businesses and I'd seen my dad do these side hustles and I'd had a taste for the Del Boy, like the Only Fools and Horses style uh-huh. businesses when we were at car boot sales and stuff like that. And I was like, right, I want to run a business. I used to dream about having a business that had lots of different businesses, right? And I only remembered this dream recently, but I used to dream about it. And it was a big building and on each floor you had a different department. So you'd have sales, marketing, finance, like HR, just the titles that I knew about, right?
I love that you have as many HR people as you have salespeople. That's something's going wrong there.
It's a recruitment business. So, you know, I had this dream of this big building and I think I'd thought about it in office terms because I'd seen my dad's office and stuff. And there were departments on each floor. And then on the top or the bottom floor, I can't remember, there were different businesses. And there was a team that ran each business that would then work across all of the different floors to run their business. And now I've studied business. That's just like a matrix structure of business. That's basically the business that I've built. Like, it's not gonna, I run a junior business on this. I only realized that I used to have that dream literally 20 odd years ago in the last year or so. And I'm like, man, that's probably shaped me. But so I remember I used to have this dream. And then I vividly remember when I was 13, I decided I wanted to run my own business. I decided that's what I wanted to do. And we were driving to Essex. A lot of my mum's family is from Essex. I remember sitting in the back of the car. I had a notepad and pen with me. And I drew a spider diagram. And I brainstormed all the different businesses that I could run. And it was buying and selling things. It was consultancy. You know, these are like kid versions of these. I can't remember exactly how I wrote that. Like, making clothes and selling them, all lots of different ideas. And in this 1 hour car journey, I kind of wrote all these things out and I was probably quite quiet for once. And then I explained to mum and dad and my brother, who wasn't interested, that this is what I'm going to do. I said, this is everything that I want to do. This is everything that I can do now. And here is the room that I think is best for me to be able to do this. Look, I don't have any money, but selling my ideas to a marketing company, I can do now. Like, there's no restrictions for me doing that. So I kind of made this plan and I thought in my head that I want to run my own business. I'm not going to start a business and buy this office and recruit all of the staff now. But I can build up to that. So the first one that there were no blockers on and I needed no money was, I'm going to write a letter to some of my favorite companies and tell them that I had the best new marketing strategy for them that is going to change their world. I'm in their target market. It's fresh ideas. So I wrote to like 10 companies as a 13-year-old, and only one of them came back. Actually, no, I think two, but one of them ended up in a meeting, and it was Silver Spoon Sugar. So I went into Silver Spoon Sugar, and I presented my marketing ideas as a 13-year-old to their marketing director, some other people. They put me in the big board room. They like sat me around. I prepared this presentation. Now, the secret is, Jody, that I didn't have any marketing ideas when I sent all of these letters. I sent all of these letters, and when I got the reply, I was like, oh, better come up with some ideas. And actually, okay, they were probably rubbish. But they said to me, and I went with my dad, they said, the presentation you've given, we see presentations all the time from people all age, like 40, 50 year olds. They said, this is one of the best presentations we've ever seen. And they gave me a big bag of sugar and like treats and stuff like that. They showed me their new marketing material, which was about to launch, and asked my opinion. And look, I like presenting. I'm not going to say that, yes, that was the best presentation they've ever seen. But the fact they told me that, and I believed it at the time, it made me realize it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what access you have. You can make things happen. You can knock on doors. You can like build relationships. You can come up with ideas. You can like buy and sell things. And that for me was so empowering that I was like, I can't be stopped now. I can do whatever I want.
So as a 13-year-old, just some of the concepts that you've mentioned, target audience, marketing, spider diagrams, like just this concept that you could plan your own career. I mean, there are 30-year-olds that wouldn't sit in a car and plan that all out. Like, what does it come from?
Boredom, I think.
But like, yeah, but you're bored and you put the TV on or you're bored and you look out the window. Like,
So I think actually, and this is a really interesting point for this topic, is it's all like, almost like channel boredom. I would watch TV, like, of course I would, and I would go and play with my friends, and I would, like, we swam a lot and did whatever. I remember my brother had a paper round which I had to go help him with and never got any money for, but I'm not bitter about that. and you know, we did all these things, but it was channeled boredom. So I never had in my body that, or I was trained out of thinking, I don't have any time, so I'm going to put the TV on and I'm going to sit here all day. That would be boring for me. Mm-hmm. I remember one time Dad took my brother and I to golf lessons for quite a while, and I remember walking past the golf house and Keenan and Kel, do you remember Keenan and Kel, were on the TV, and it was on like Saturday morning, whatever. And I remember getting really annoyed because I was like, I don't like these golf lessons. And Keenan and Kel were on at the same time. I'm never going to be able to see Keenan and Kel because I have to come to golf lessons, which my parents pushed me to do stuff, piano lessons, stuff like that. But if I didn't want to do them, I wouldn't do them. They always kind of made me do things for about a month if I showed an interest, and then I moved on. And I think because of that, I was in the habit of doing stuff. If I was at home watching Keenan and Kel every Saturday, I'd probably want to have gone golf lessons because I just always wanted to do stuff. So the motivation was always there because I was trained. I suppose it is trained. I never really thought that. I've been trained to just do stuff. And the knowledge, the spider diagrams I think we'd done at school, the thinking about how like different businesses and stuff like that. We're talking really rudimentary stuff here. You know, I wasn't planning the businesses that we run today. It was just the very early stages of how like fundamental things work, which came from my desire to always find out how things work, like break things down. And my parents and my ecosystem, my family's keenness to have these conversations.
So when you were planning out your businesses and when you were younger, what did you have a concept of success, and did you have a picture in your mind of what success might look like?
Yeah, and it's changed so much.
What was it then?
Money.
Money to buy?
No, success tokens.
Okay, got you. So success was the amount of money that you had?
Early on. And actually, no, maybe not to start with. Maybe that became the thing. I think early on, it was to create. It was to do something. I was always excited. And I was always proud that people were proud of me, actually. I always got a level of satisfaction when people were like, what? Like, you're doing this? And like, you're like 14. I remember actually, my uncle had a load of ironmongery at one stage, like 300 tons of ironmongery on a farmyard in Essex. And I took over selling it. I took like a half term, and this is when I was 16 or 15. And I was selling it for him, and I was contacting people. I spent some time with my auntie, my mum's sister, and she like taught me how to write letters to people, address people, like use a fax machine, stuff like that. And I never forget when a guy came to visit. He ran a big hardware company, and this stock was worth about £1 million. And he got out of his car, and I came out of the cabin as a 15 or 16 year old, and his face was like, "What?" I just totally dropped. I thrived on that. Like, I thrived on, I suppose, overachieving, really, and surprising people. That then has continued to drive me, but to encourage people to also do that, to think beyond what they think is possible, that really drives me now. So I think early on it was to create, to surprise, to add value. Then I think probably from the age of like 17 or so, it became more about money. And I think that's more because, maybe 16 or so, I think that's more because when our understanding of business and entrepreneurship from not within the world is money. It's like, if you're doing well, you make more money. If you make less money, you're doing less well. That's what people think. It's not true, by the way. Anybody listening that thinks that, it's not true. So I was kind of in that world. I'd seen I was always inspired by my uncle, always did really well, drove Range Rovers, had nice houses, stuff like that. And I was like, man, that's good. That's the lifestyle I actually want. And then as I kind of grew up, went through university, ran a couple of businesses. I ran a paintballing company that was in partnership with another paintballing company. I made this guy quite a bit of money. Our companies were in partnership, and my company made his money, a company, a lot of money. And I found out that he was actually, I was 19 at the time, found out, or 18, found out that he was actually like cheating me. He was trying to pull like probably about £600 extra or something, which was nothing with the amounts we were dealing with. And I thought, wow, that is greedy. That is what money will get you. Mm-hmm. And if you optimize on money and it becomes everything, you'll have nothing. Fundamentally believe in that. And then I really pinged the other way, and I went into, I just want to have a social impact. So I ran a socially focused enterprise with someone, and we ran a company called My Health Cards, did health cards for people with food allergies and intolerances. And then that was great, but it wasn't very commercial, and I'm actually really commercial, so I lost interest in that. Then I went into another business that was all about having fun. Like, I worked with a guy who became a really close friend, and success then was managed on how much fun are we having? Like, are we laughing more than we're like not? And that's success. But then actually that like was good, but my motivation and ambition wanted to drive me further than that. So I then joined something called the New Entrepreneurs Foundation, after university this is now. And that was all about learning. I knew I wasn't going to start anything amazing. I wasn't going to have a social impact. I wasn't going to make loads of money in that year. The New Entrepreneurs Foundation is an amazing 12-month program that pairs you with a high-growth company that you work within, but also gives you exposure to an amazing network, learning opportunities, mentoring. And I was only motivated. Success was all about learning for me. And then at the end of that, I feel, right, I do want to continue to learn, but I just want to add value again. So going full circle back to why I started. And I did quite a bit of consultancy. Mm-hmm. And my motivation was, yes, I was getting an okay day rate, mm-hmm. but I wanted to go into a business and leave knowing that business is better than my time in there.
So it started with the money side, then it moved to the...
I think it was more like wanting to create
something. Started with creating something, then moved to the money, then moved to the social impact, yeah. then moved to the having fun, then yeah. moved to the learning. Yeah. And now, what you're doing now is probably a combination of all of those things.
That's why it's so good!
Yay!
So from the learning, also then into the value creation. And then actually, it was probably about 5 or so years ago when someone asked me to do a talk on how to freelance your way to success. And instead of being like a normal person and writing a talk and doing a talk, I really went introspective. And I was like, well, I can't do this because I actually don't know what success is. So I spoke to people who I considered highly successful and realized most of them are desperately unhappy. Most people who have what are like the old me would have considered success, lots of money, lots of like, you know, like really like status, they were just unhappy. I also thought about my granddad, who my grandparents had a really big impact on me, I think, and he passed away before he retired. But his whole life was about preparing for his retirement. And I was thinking, crikey, like, what a shame, you know? That rips me up to think that.
So how old were you when that happened?
I was quite young. Mm-hmm. I was probably 9 or 13.
Okay.
My nan and granddad on my mum's side both died when I was around that age.
Well, because you mentioned earlier in something you were saying, you mentioned about having a finite amount of time as a person, and you knew that you couldn't necessarily do all the careers that you wanted to do. Yeah. So is it because of your grandparents passing away at quite a young age? Did that give you a good sense of mortality?
Maybe. Before my finite amount of time was more in terms of time in the day to add value.
Okay.
But I think that's probably the same mental system of the whole, like, we're only here for so long. Probably did. And I think, I mean, it's a fact, isn't it? Like, we are only here for so long. And why spend one day unhappy when you can be happy? Why spend one day not doing what you want to do when actually there is a choice to do what you want to do? And it might not bring you what the social system might make you think you want, whether that be wealth or status or whatever, but it might make you really happy. And I think that having this understanding of mortality makes you appreciate that we are that time is finite, but also we have a we can take responsibility for what we want to do. I think that probably is a big thing that I've not really really thought of before.
So then the last thing I want to talk about, and it sort of goes back to what you said about the car boot sale and your dad handing you 50p and asking, getting you to, oh no, was it 50p? And getting you to buy something for £1 or something like that.
I mean, there was just like thousands of experiences like that.
And because I know you've got a nephew, mm-hmm. is there anything like that? Are there any little practices that you're passing on to try and develop that kind of enterprising behaviour in your nephew?
So not as much as I'd like yet. So Theo, my nephew, is just, I mean, like, I melt every time I see or hear him. Like, he's just incredible. Unfortunately, he loves my girlfriend just as much as he does love me. So every time I speak to him on the phone, he's like, "Where's Tara?" And I'm like, "Theo, love me." But yeah, absolutely. So now he's three, he's starting to really have conversations. I think at this stage, not necessarily on the enterprise perspective, but I think what I'm really keen to make sure he gets is this confidence, this self-belief, this ability to ask questions, to think beyond what's just put in front of him. And then if he wants to run a business, then yes, that's amazing. But actually, if he wants to become a lawyer or a doctor or like work in a restaurant or whatever, that's absolutely perfect. And I would love to support him in everything that he wants. But I think that now is the time to develop this. Remember I was saying about this nub of like creativity, of asking questions, of like not just seeing everything on face value, and then just giving him a really wide exposure. And yes, enterprise education is important into that, because I think enterprise skills is much more valuable than a lot of other skills to go across the board. So he can do anything he wants and utilize enterprise skills, which I think at the root are asking questions, are understanding how things work, our mental, emotional intelligence, things like that, resilience, like passion, drive. And I think that I'm keen to get that into him. One thing from a really early age I remember, which I think had a really big impact, is, and this goes back down to confidence, is my parents, my grandparents, my family put me in situations which would stretch me, but the downside in hindsight probably was never that hard, that bad. And if it was, then they were always there to support me. And from a really early stage, I remember if I stayed at my grandparents and I came down the stairs, they would always make such a big fuss of us. "Oh, you look amazing. Like, oh, you look so smart. Wow, what are we going to do today?" Like, and I remember it being such a thing that before, if I was staying at theirs, before I would come down the stairs or whatever, like, I would really do my side parting to look smart. I would really, you know, because I loved that and I felt that warmth. And that made me have a big smile on my face. And I'd walk out the door and I'd know that, like, my side parting was on point and I could go and speak to someone. And that confidence, that like, belief just radiates from within and enables you to apply yourself to things that, doesn't matter what it is. Like, if Theo or my children, when I have children, want to run a business, that's amazing. If they don't, that's amazing. But the thing I most want to pass on is that they really take time and consideration about not what they are, but who they are, and not necessarily what they're doing, but how they're doing it, and just doing things to the best of their ability for their enjoyment, for the benefit of themselves, their family, society, people around them, and just making sure that they get this fulfillment and this feeling of success. We said about success, and the reason why I feel content every day and I love what I'm doing is because I have a mix of those five things that I've been quite extreme with in the past. I experience them every day. my main thing is to encourage them to have a wider view of everything available, understanding what they love, what they don't love, and encouraging them and giving them the confidence and empowerment for them to select what is important to them as a person, mm-hmm. and design a life for them to really achieve that.
Nice. Okay, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about you?
I'm online almost everywhere under Mike Bandar, B-A-N-D-A-R. So whether that's Twitter, email mike@mikebandar.com, LinkedIn, anywhere. I'd love to hear from people.
Perfect. Thank you so much. This episode was brought to you by Clever Tykes Children's Storybooks. If you want to support the podcast and help share our ethos of inspiring, enterprising behaviour, head over to clevertykes.com and order a set of the storybooks to give to a child that you know.